Well, it's great to be here and somewhat frustrating to be asked to speak about finance and not about physics, but I guess I'm the only one to blame. So I'm going to give you a little review of what's been going on in this field, at least from a physics from the physics community point of view. And okay, I'm going to try to do it on the blackboard. Usually it takes a little time because there are a few things that have to be defined and so on. There's quite a lot of data as well. So I'll try to strip it down to minimum, but we'll see how it goes. So why are physicists interested in that field, apart from the holy grail of making money, I guess? Well, I think that the real reason is that since in the past 10 years, data has become available, data of all sorts, very precise sometimes. Everything you want to look at in financial markets, now you can download pretty easily. So this goes obviously from the daily prices of stocks, daily prices of indices, of currencies, of commodities like gold or oil and so on. But financial markets have diversified and now can be very complex, like for example bond markets or option markets, and you can also get data from these. And actually now you can even get data, and I'll give you a little bit of information about that, about the core of the way markets function. I mean the intimate behavior at the micro level of how markets function, that is all the orders that people put in the markets, the way it changes the price, the way the price changes the orders, and so on, all this can be analyzed in full details. And actually the amount of data is such that it really competes sometimes with the best data set that we have in physics, like for example turbulence flows, that has been the subject of intense study, as you know. And sometimes the quantity of data is really comparable to these wind tunnel experiments, for example. So a lot of data, and so possibly ways to compare ideas with data. So this is a motivation for physicists usually. But apart from this, why should we care? Well, the finance industry is now very greedy to hire physicists because they have a lot of problems that need to be solved using data. And so handling data is useful to construct these models that are going to be used. And these are going to be used for risk control, first of all. So this is really now one of the big concern of financial institutions, is to know what they are doing, really. This curiously wasn't really the case before. But now they are compelled to do so by international regulators that ask them to be very specific and in the way they publish their risk figures. So this needs modeling. The whole field of derivative pricing, which I'm not going to be able to talk about, also needs models. So just in one quick word, an option is like an insurance on a stock. So if you buy stocks, you can also buy a kind of insurance. If you want to protect yourself against the fall of the stock market, you can buy to a financial institution what's called a put option, which is something that is going to guarantee that your portfolio, if the market goes below a certain threshold, won't be worth less than this threshold. So you can buy this. This is an option contract. But these contracts are actually now, since 1973 actually, also traded on open markets. So if you buy this option contract, you can sell it back later. And so there's a derivative market which has been constructed around these products, where options themselves become means of speculations. And the way these options are related to the underlying stock price is an interesting problem that's well known in the field and goes under the name of the Black-Scholes model. Just in a word, if you write contract insurance for drivers, you need to know something about the probabilistic behavior of these drivers. Well, it's more or less the same for these option contracts. You need to know something about the statistics of the objects on which you write these contracts. And in particular, sometimes you need also to know what what are the big events that, and what is the probability of the big events.
If you trade options, do you take options on options?
Yeah, that's actually also the case. There are now options on options. Actually, when you trade options, you trade what I'm going to tell later. You trade something that people call the volatility, which is the local temperature. And now there are options on the volatility, which. So, but this is interesting because the financial engineering world is really developing these products ad infinitum. And actually, one of the reasons is that when these products are new, people don't know exactly what they're worth. And so you can make a lot of money when you're a bank by trading products that people don't really understand. Anyway, okay, there's a last part which I won't have time to discuss in much details either, but a lot of people in the recent years have tried to develop automated trading engines based on fine-tuned statistical analysis of these financial markets and try to identify trading patterns and, of course, control the risk associated with these trading schemes. So all this is also quite interesting, actually. Anyway, this is a little bit driven by applications, but I think there's a more fundamental reason why one should be interested as scientists, but also as citizens, is, and the question is, should we trust the stock market prices? I mean, do they say something real about the economy? Can we base our decisions to buy stocks or to sell a company or whatever? I mean, all these economic decisions, can we trust the stock market prices to give us some indication about the future prospects of the economy? And as you imagine, this is extremely important, and the last decades has shown that perhaps this is a wrong idea to trust too much the stock markets. On the other hand, from the traditional economic theory point of view, this is what you should do. In traditional economics, markets are supposed to be efficient, which means that prices are fixed by a rational assessment of the economic situation. And therefore, prices are only driven by changes of information. I mean, changes of prices are driven by real information. So as information is by definition, as new information is by definition random, I mean, because otherwise would not be information, prices essentially change randomly. And that's the basic tenet of the efficient market theory, is that prices are completely unpredictable, or else that the current price is actually the best predictor of future prices at any time. Okay? So this is a very important idea that actually pervades all the economic theory, and if compared to what I said before, it's very important, because if this is true, well, then even at the peak of the internet bubble, we should have trusted these prices as the best estimate of future prices. So the way markets actually achieve to do such a thing, that is to compute exactly these correct prices, is pretty mysterious. And within the context of efficient market theory, it's more an axiom than anything else.
But is this theory or reality?
No, okay, so that's the whole, my whole seminar is going to be about that. So that's you know, what you have on one side. But of course, it seems very weird, and that's what I was about to say. I mean, from intuition, there seems to be something wrong about this. So are the market rational? That's the left theory. Not left, I shouldn't say that. I mean, the theory on one side. And now have emerged, even within the context of economics theory, a new branch which is called behavioral finance or behavioral economy, which very often meets the questions that physicists would ask, which in this context, the question is whether the price wouldn't be more the result of a collective behavior. In that sense, news would kind of trigger some changes, like thermal noise in a sense, but these changes would be enormously amplified by a collective system, which is that of traders interacting through the price, actually. And it seems, as was already pointed out, quite obvious that something like this must be the case. I mean, the common experience is that volatility is extremely high in financial markets. And actually, that's a puzzle, that's a well-known puzzle of the efficient market theory, is people ask, why is the volatility so high? If prices were really reflecting some kind of underlying economic truth, then prices should vary much less than they actually do. So this was actually shown more rigorously, more formally by some economists some 20 years ago. So there is this excess volatility puzzle, but it seems to all of us, I guess, very obvious that there's something strange. And what I'm going to be more specific about is that if you look at the data, you see various things that are familiar to physicists. That is, you see power laws in the distributions, power laws in correlations. And so somehow this suggests that there is a kind of critical-like behavior around this, and perhaps a proximity of some kind of critical point, which would really suggest a collective phenomenon. But in any case, whatever, even if the markets are not exactly critical, but close to it, the whole idea here is to try to construct ab initio models that would be reasonable from intuitive point of view, of models of traders that interact with themselves and with a price, and to see what these models can give as far as statistics is concerned. So if you want, on the one side, there's this axiomatic theory, which looks pretty weird. And on the other side, they're now the aim, which is by no means completed. I mean, it's still very much an active research. This approach, this endeavor to try to model the markets from a microscopic point of view, ab initio point of view. Okay, so before trying to cover that, the first thing I'm going to give you is a short overview of what you see when you look at data. Okay, so I'm going to call P of T the price of an asset. And actually, the asset I'm going to consider is not really relevant because, as I'm going to emphasize at the end, all the features that I'm going to discuss are pretty generic and don't really depend on what kind of markets you consider, whether you consider stock markets or whatever kind of other markets. It's pretty robust. So P is the price, and people very often study price variations defined in a relative way. That is, delta X would be the delta price over the price. So that would be in percent. That's the usual way of thinking about price changes. And delta X would be, for example, measured between one day and next day. So this would be, if you had daily data, you would be interested in the price increments or relative price increments, but I have used the word price increments even to describe these relative price increments. Between T and T plus one can be one day if you're interested in daily timescales, but it can be much longer and it can be much shorter. Sometimes you're interested in one being 10 minutes or so. So you have if you have a lot of data, you can actually study the statistics of these delta X across different timescales, from a few minutes to a few months. Okay, so that's the definition of delta X. And so what you can try to see if you have a data set are different questions. The first one, which is obvious if you want to trade, if you want to devise an automated trading engine, is to look for linear correlations. So perhaps this won't be surprising to you, but if you look at delta xi, delta xj, where I and j are discretized time steps, then this decays very fast. So this roughly is exponential of minus I minus j over some time scale, tau. And tau on very liquid markets is around 10 minutes. So to a first approximation, as long as you're interested in time scales which are not too short, then you can think of price changes to be uncorrelated. That means that you can't devise really a linear filter to make money. This is perhaps not very surprising. So you could ask, but if there are correlations on the scale of 10 minutes, then perhaps trading very fast would make money. Well, but then you face transaction costs, which acts like friction. And as much like friction, if you make the engine rotate very fast, you dissipate a lot. And in this case, you can work out that, roughly speaking, the amount of money you would be able to do by trading these correlations is completely eaten up by transaction costs, even if you have direct access to markets. But anyway, to a fast approximation, you can forget about linear correlations.
Has this been this time been time dependent?
As yes. 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 If you look at the same, this is recent data. This is data from the 90s. If you look at data from the 60s on the American market, you find that this was substantially longer, like 2 hours. So indeed, there seems to be some correlation between the fact that transaction costs have diminished and the fact that these correlations have been eaten away on shorter timescales.
Is that progress?
I don't know. I mean, I'm just going to describe things. Then you can judge for your own.
But you're the part that the number of transactions become much bigger.
Well, but it did because the transaction costs went down.
But probably time needed for one transaction also decreased.
Yes, sure.
So ratio probably hasn't changed too much.
Well, I think, yeah, I don't know that.
But
I think
at least measuring the limits
means. Yeah, but transactions were already quite fast in the 60s, I think. Yeah, right, but now it's just. Okay, anyway. So. I'm going to talk a little bit about it. So, I'm insisting here already, because it's obvious from a mathematical point of view, but sometimes one thinks that it's. A detail and not very important, the fact that there is no linear correlation doesn't mean that price increments are independent. Linear correlations, of course, is just a very weak form of correlation of independence. Absence of linear correlations is not at all full independence. And I'm going to comment a lot on that in a few minutes. So once you have these price increments, something else that you can look for is the distribution P of delta x. And what you find is that, say, on the daily time scale, well, let me draw a little bit how it looks like. So if I plot log of P of delta x versus delta x, then what you find is that on short time scales, so let me remind you that in this representation, the Gaussian would be like this. So on short time scales, what you get is an extremely chaotic distribution, that means with very heavy tails. And then as time progresses up to a rescaling of price changes, you slowly converge. So I should say as tau increases here, you slowly converge to the Gaussian distribution. But very, very slowly, even after 1 month, you still see tails in the distribution much beyond the Gaussian. So if you try to fit these tails here, this has been done recently actually using enormous sets of data sets by mixing together, for example, the fluctuations of all stocks in the American stock market. Then you find that P of delta x decays as a power law. Actually, it's quite convincing because there are two or three decades to determine this exponent mu. And mu is found to be in the range 3 to 4.
So does the exponent depend very much on the industry?
No. This exponent is universal. It's also the same if you look at different stock markets. So this has been checked for US stocks, but also the DAX and the Japanese stock market.
Right. So how universal? I mean, is it this really true? As universal as in statistical mechanics?
Well, it's hard to say because there's, I mean, it's, you know, there are, it's very hard to ascertain things with precision in this field, because here you're making, in order to have a lot of data to probe the tails, because in the tails, of course, you have by definition less events, so you need a lot of events to determine that. So, for example, the way you do that is to pool together all the stocks up to a rescaling of their natural variations. So this is already assuming something about stocks. And then you can go back and look at each stock individually and see that there are fluctuations from stock to stock, but they don't seem to be statistically significant. So, I mean, it looks pretty much universal. On the other hand, you could also say that we have a unique planet. So, you know, Japanese stocks and DAX are not so different because the same people are actually trading on all these markets. So, but the real point here is that the distribution is very non-Gaussian on short time scales and progressively but very slowly becomes Gaussian on longer time scales. If price changes were not only uncorrelated but independent, then the convergence of this curve to the Gaussian would just be governed by the central limit theorem. And one would know everything about the convergence as well. You could really make a detailed prediction of how, as the time scale increases, you deform this curve from being non-Gaussian to being Gaussian. And what you see by different measurements is that actually the speed of convergence towards the Gaussian is much slower than if prices were independent random variables. Okay, so
how these that you describe, they independent of whether the stock market is going up or down.
Yes. Yeah, I should say that again. I mean, here I've said that when I said the timescales here. You can look at timescales between 1 minute and a few months. Beyond 1 month, it becomes an issue whether the markets are going down or up.
But even in a big crash, this exponent is the same.
Yes. Oh, yes. And what is interesting is actually even the 1987 crash of 22% in the American stock market is not an outlier when you take this distribution. So everything I'm going to speak about here are on timescales such that average trends can be neglected compared to fluctuations. And if you went to larger timescales, then trends would be an issue. And then you would have to also discuss about more economic problems. In this case, short timescales, it seems that trading is going on all the time. So there's it actually ties with the whole problem of knowing whether markets are efficient or not. But it seems very hard to believe that, fluctuations within a day have anything to do with real economic news. Anyway, so this is the point here. And what I want to emphasize is that a traditional model of statistics in stock markets, which have been used in the financial industry for decades, and for which actually many people have had the Nobel Prizes in economics, is the Gaussian distribution. So if you assume that the distribution is Gaussian on all time scales and price increments are independent, then you construct the Brownian motion in physics, but you also construct the Black-Scholes-Bacheli model in financial mathematics. And for years, all the risk control and the option pricing problems that I referred to earlier was done using the Gaussian distribution. And as you know, as statistical physicists, we also love the Gaussian distribution because there's a lot one can do. Unfortunately, for financial application, big crashes are totally underestimated by factors like 10 to the 23 for the American crash. So there must be something deeply wrong in this Gaussian assumption.
But the center reflects where the overall average is going at any given time.
Yeah, but again, the center here, I mean, this is related to the trend. If you look at a graph like this for daily price increments, even if there's a trend of 10% a year, you don't see it. Because 10% a year, if you work what it means on a single day, it gives an average which is extremely small compared to the fluctuation of a stock, which is around 3% a day. Okay, so you don't see it. You can just forget it.
Would you regard the failure of that company, long-term capital management, to the...
You're very much ahead of time.
All right.
Okay, so...
excuse me, if relatively short-term trends, a day, a few days, are lost in the noise here, so if banks or governments were trying to manipulate the market, it might be hidden.
provided they didn't get greedy and try to do it all at once?
Well, you know, I think that many people try to manipulate the markets in some way or other, and banks don't really have much of a competitive advantage on that. And this is related to the fact, to something that I'm going to talk about, is if you want to manipulate markets, you should be very careful not to get burned. And even if you want to buy and sell as an individual, the very fact of buying or selling actually affects the market. So this is called slippage. And so the fact that you want to buy pushes the price a little bit up. So you're going to buy a little above the price you thought you could reach, and so you're going to lose money. And this is actually a very substantial effect. Even if you're quite small, you don't need to be a bank to suffer this effect. So, I mean, you know, people are very careful not to do things that they would regret later.
This is an issue, this two-way correlation that holds. It's a bit clear on the condition that the correlation doesn't give you the information that allows you to make money, let's say. Can you classify the most general endpoint correlation such with that constraint and say how far?
Yeah, okay, I'm going to speak about this now. Okay, so I've insisted in Jorge's questions about that. So what about nonlinear correlations? So for example, something that you can look at is what people call the volatility-volatility correlation function, which now I need to subtract an average. Here again, I didn't subtract any average because of the reason that the average is lost in the fluctuations. But now I need to subtract it. So if you want, delta X is the trend of the market times an amplitude. So there's a sign and an amplitude. If you square it, you remove the sign. And so this thing is big if the market is volatile, is nervous, whatever direction it goes. And so you can ask, well, if the market is nervous at time I, is it going to be nervous still at time J? And this is what is measured by this correlation function. And what you see again on very different markets is that actually now decays extremely slowly. Decays something like power law. I'm going to show you a little bit of data about this, with an exponent nu, which is on the order of 0.2, 0.3. So this is very, very, very slow. And what it means, so there are two things. First of all, it's slow. So if you look at the correlation function after 100 days, it's still 10%, whereas here it was 10% after 5 minutes. So there's really completely different timescales. But also the fact that it's I minus j to the nu and not an exponential means that there is no single timescale to govern this loss of correlation. You can actually, as you know, I mean, a fit is a fit, so you can fit it by different forms. You can fit it by a sum of three exponentials if you want with three different timescales, but you need at least three in order to make a good job. So there are at least three timescales governing the dynamics of this object, one very short one, one average one around 20 days, and one very long one. So this is this means that volatility is random, first of all. And the fact that it has this power law aspect is known as volatility clustering. So this means that when volatility is high, it tends to remain high for a while, and the time scale over which it remains high can be anything from 1 minute to several years. So let me show that, because this is an interesting graph. That's not focused. Does it do it automatically, or should I? I don't know how to use it. Anyway, I think you see what's going on.
Turn the lens.
Okay, thank you. So what you see here is the American stock market since the beginning of the 20th century, 1900 to 2000. And what is plotted here is actually delta x on a daily time scale. So this is the daily return, daily price change, relative price change. And this is what you would have if you had a Brownian random walk. So you see there are two major differences. The first one is that, as well known, the Gaussian decay is so fast that you don't see any spike away from 3 sigma, say. Whereas here you see a lot of spikes. So this is related to these fat tails. But you see something else that you wouldn't get if the increments were independent, which is clustering. So you see that this is the 1930s. And in the 30s, the volatility was gigantic for 5 years. And it remained high for 5 years. And you see that there were days where the market went up like 20% in the 30s. But overall, if you remember, between 1929 and 1938, the markets went down by 90%. So it was a complete meltdown that you absolutely don't see on this graph. So here, volatility remained high for 5 years. Here you have a period in the beginning of the 60s where it was pretty small. And if you blow up this graph and look at what happens during a decade or during a year or even during a day, you see the same kind of pattern. That is, volatility seems to be clustered on all timescales. And intuitively, it's true that, you know, when you have big geopolitical events like currently, you might have volatility going on for years. But sometimes you have a rumor which makes the volatility of markets jump through the roof, but then the rumor is dead in a few minutes, and the volatility reverts back to normal.
That first negative one, is that the First World War?
Here? Yeah, I think it is. It's not a real point, this one, because if you, I don't know if you know, but the market closed for 2 months in 1914. So this is not a day, actually. This is, when the market closed and reopened 2 months later. Okay, so of course you can encapsulate this in this correlation function, but I think it's much more intuitive what it means if you see this pattern. There's another nonlinear correlation function which is non-trivial, which is, for reasons I won't explain, called the leverage effect, which is a kind of mix between this linear one and this square-square one, which is you put one linear and one squared. And then if j is greater than I, then this is non-zero. I mean, I won't discuss what it looks like. But what it means is that if prices go down at time I, then the future volatility is increased. And you see that very clearly also on beta. There's a correlation between prices going down and people getting more nervous and the volatility increasing. So you see all these things show very clearly that even if you have zero linear correlations, then these objects are non-trivial, so it can't be independent.
So I larger than J, you cannot have non-zero because it would allow you to earn money.
Exactly.
Now, in that correlation function, can you write down the functional form?
So delta xi can have both signs, but the square thing has only plus sign, right? So
yes, right.
So there's a difference when delta xi is positive or
negative? Yeah, it's negative. I mean, it's minus.
Oh, it's always negative.
Yeah, it's minus, well, okay, one can argue, but it's not badly fit with something like this, again, with an amplitude here, and a time tau, which is around 20 days. But the data is much more noisy, so you could argue.
Negative.
Oh, yes, it's negative.
Positive.
Yeah, you have to be a little careful. There's some structure hidden here that I don't want to go into. I'm sorry?
Can you write down what mutual information between delta xi, delta xj goes? How's the mutual information between these two deltas go?
What do you mean, mutual information?
Standard Chan mutual.
Oh, well, okay, you can do that. I haven't done that, so I wouldn't be able to. Some people have done that. I could give you references. Okay, so if you remember the graph that I showed you a minute ago, actually, phenomenologically, it resembles much turbulent flows as well, where dissipation is clustered in small regions of space. And so there are quite a lot of models that have been proposed for turbulent flows, which actually are also very useful to describe stock markets. And I'm just going to give a name because I think this model is very beautiful, a model by Bakri, Musy, and Delour, that essentially write that delta xi is some random variable with this time iid with variance normalized, say. So this would be Gaussian, for example, but no structure whatsoever. And then multiply by something that they write as exponential of omega I. Well, now the omega I's have long-range correlations. So it goes like minus log of a minus j minus lambda squared log of a minus j over capital T. So if you want, this is the sign part, this is the volatility part. And if you write the volatility part as the exponential of a Gaussian with long-range correlation, with logarithmic correlations for this random variable, then you get something which fits the data very well, first of all. For example, you can get a relation between this nu and the lambda here, which is...
What does IID stand for?
Independent, identically distributed.
Oh, okay. So epsilon I, each epsilon I satisfies some Gaussian.
Right. Gaussian or whatever distribution.
The same width.
With same width.
It doesn't have to be Gaussian.
No.
The Isaac
right. Spin, yeah, for example. But the whole structure is put... So you see that... By construction, satisfy absence of linear correlations. But then you get the nonlinear correlations through this. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm insisting on this model without really defining it is that it has some deep connections with the models in disordered systems, like a glass model of a particle in a random disorder. So there's a paper by Carpentier and Le Doussal.
So this model is predictive then, once you've given the data.
Yeah, actually, yes, you can do things with this model which allow you, for example, to predict ways that the volatility is going to revert back. So this is related to various problems in statistical physics, like one particle in a random potential, but also a Dirac particle in a random gauge field. And so this model is actually multifractal and has a lot of interesting.
Can you reduce that correlation function?
No, there's no skew in this version of the model, but you can extend the model to have some skew. This has a skew because it distinguishes between going down and going up.
I see.
But you can implement something to get the skew as well.
So that model, it would give zero for that.
Yeah, correlation. Right. Okay, so that's more or less what I wanted to say about the statistics. But what I've said here just concerns single assets. And of course, you can ask, and you've asked about this, you can ask about, you know, what happens when you look simultaneously at different stocks. What is the multivariate statistics of whole stocks together of stock markets and bond markets and so on? So this becomes an enormous world. And there are more things that one could talk about. And I won't because I don't have time. But just a word because I think it would be of interest for some people here. If you now put an index alpha to designate a stock, then it's well known that stocks move to some extent move together. So you can look at the correlation function, the stock-stock correlation function, and this defines a matrix, C alpha beta. And you can ask, and that's very useful if you want to construct portfolios, you can ask about the statistics of the eigenvalues of this matrix. And what you find, for example, for the American SP 500, which has 500 stocks, so it's a 500 by 500 matrix, and there are 10 eigenvalues which are significant, and the rest, 490, are actually very well predicted by a random matrix theory for the spectrum of eigenvalues. So it's a quite an unexpected application of random matrix theory, but
sum over I there, or you don't have to sum over I, just any I.
Well, this is I is time, so you average over I is time.
Same I.
So it's the same I. You look at the correlation, the single day correlation of stocks together, and you actually this average means averaging over I now.
Right. So you do sum over I.
Sure. Okay, there's an interesting question about extreme correlations as well. This object here is just the usual definition of correlation.
When you look at the eigenvectors, do you see,
yeah, you
make sense?
You see also that most eigenvectors are given by the Porter-Thomas statistics, but some of them are not, and they coincide with the ones which...
You mean the Porter-Thomas is usually eigenvectors?
Yeah, that's what he said. And the eigen, well, this is a definite positive matrix, so it's not Wigner-Dyson, but it's something related to Wigner-Dyson.
And how these eigenvectors actually depend on I? If you will diagonalize and then follow each of them depending on I.
Yeah, well, so you need some timescale to actually average. Mm-hmm. And then you can make a sliding average. And the question is, can you distinguish the evolution of the relevant eigenvectors from noise? And that's something that I think people don't know how to do yet. Anyway, so what I wanted to, this was a kind of side remark, but what I wanted to emphasize about the previous properties, I need to write again P of delta x like 1 over delta x is 1 plus mu, with mu in the range 3 to 4. What is really interesting is that to some extent these results are universal. I've said that already. But this exponent, as I told you, is very robust when you change even markets, when you look at currency markets, which have in principle nothing to do with stock markets, then you find the same kind of distribution. This exponent also seems to be robust. I mean, it's also always very small, and the volatility takes a long time to revert back. And actually, qualitatively, the phenomenon you can see even in 18th century wheat markets. If you look at wheat markets a long time ago, then they show this volatility clustering. They are very similar to the graph I've shown you. So this is quite interesting. And so what? Well, As far as financial engineering is concerned, this is quite interesting because you can try to have better models for risk and for option prices and for trading. And okay, I won't have time to tell you about this, but you can go quite far in that direction. But what I'm going to be more interested in is can one construct microscopic models that are reasonable, like the Ising model for magnets, and that are able to reproduce at least qualitatively these behavior, and what can one understand where these come from? So how much time do I have? Well, this is an hour, I guess. Okay, so I have to cut enormously. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about what people call the order book, which is on the micro level how markets actually function, how orders to buy and to sell flow in and interact to make the price change. I think this is actually one of the nicest possible application of statistical mechanics is to describe these the way these order books look like. But I'm sorry, I really don't have time to talk about that at all. So I'm going to speak about what people in the behavioral finance call agent-based models. Which is just like just this. I mean, how can you put agents with simple psychology all together and construct something that might look like a financial market? How can you construct an artificial financial market in a way? And okay, there has been already. So this is say 5 to 10 years old. So it's quite recent. And of course, there's no real good model up to now. But looking at the different models that people have proposed, there are various lessons that one can already learn. And I'll try to be a little more specific about one of them that we have studied with Irene Giardina. So if you want to reproduce, even at a qualitative level, the data I've shown you, then you have to have some non-trivial features about your agents. First of all, agents must be heterogeneous. That is, they have to have strategies which are not the same. They have to have different strategies which interact. People don't have to do the same thing, which actually is assumed in the efficient market framework, because in the efficient market framework, it only makes sense if everybody is infinitely rational. So if you're infinitely rational, you all have to take the same decision. So you have to be heterogeneous in this model and even have time-dependent strategies. So there must be some kind of adaptation in the system. The second lesson is that as soon as you try to construct such a model, you have a lot of parameters to play with. It's very hard to make a model with as few parameters as possible. So the one I'm going to refer to in a minute has at least two very relevant ones, plus other ones. But what is interesting is that parameters, so that's true for all the models, have to be to some extent tuned. Not really fine-tuned, but if you take an artificial market with parameters which are taken randomly, then certainly you don't get a realistic model. You have to choose, there are phases, so to say, and you have to put the model in the correct phase. So why is reality actually choosing the parameters to be in the phase that we see?
So it's not one of these self-organized.
Right, so then you have to argue about the system self-organizing, and that I'm going to try to be more explicit. But then as soon as you're in the correct phase, some features are robust. And these features are, for example, excess volatility, tails, and long memory. People, this thing that the volatility takes a long time to revert back is called long memory in the field. So these things, I mean, as soon as you're in the correct phase, they seem to appear quite naturally. You have different models, and they all produce some kind of excess vol, tails, and long-range volatility correlations. So I won't have time to describe in full details, but let me be slightly more specific about one of these models and show you some data to kind of substantiate my claims. So we looked at the model with Irene Giardina. Which is actually inspired by previous trials. There was one artificial market constructed in the beginning of the 90s in 94 in Santa Fe. And then in 98, there was a simplification of this model called the minority game by Zhang and co-workers. And the model I'm going to tell you, although I'm not going to give all the details, is inspired by these two things. So in the model, you have agents that are heterogeneous. They all have a bag of strategies. So a strategy is a mapping from history to decision. So the strategy is you look at the previous history, and if, for example, the history of the price was up, 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 then your strategy might tell you have to sell. And so you have a mapping from 2 to the M, where M is the memory size of the agents. So they look at M steps in the past. And it's a qualitative information, so they only look at the price sign, the price change sign. And so there are 2 to the M possible strings in the past. And for each of them, you choose one strategy. So there's a gigantic strategy space. And you take at random strategies from this strategy space and you assign them to agents. The only thing we do is to add what we call a polarization, which is a bias in strategy space, which means that if the polarization is positive, agents will be more trend followers. That is, if the majority of the sign here was plus, they are going to be more likely to choose a plus, and vice versa. So that's called trend followers in markets. And if P is negative, then it's called contrarian, for obvious reasons. OK, so that's one of the parameters of the model. So now the agents have, say, two strategies. And they are going to assign scores to these strategies. So the way they assign scores is obviously by looking at how well the strategy would have made in the past, and then comparing the score of the two strategies and choose the best one at time t. Okay. So the scores are updated through the price. But now there's a feedback loop, which is that when everybody's taken his decision, one pools together all the people who want to sell, all the people who want to buy, and the difference between supply and demand is going to give rise to different strategy means that there are people that want to buy and people that want to sell. And the difference between the buying pressure and the selling pressure is going to give rise to a delta price. Okay, so there's a feedback loop in that sense, that now the delta price is determined, people update their score and possibly change strategy. Something that is very important to add in this model is the possibility for each agent not to play. That is, there is one of the strategy which is just inactive. So we can just pull off from the market and think a little or do something else. So that's one of the parameters that you have to play with, P. And there's another one, which I'm going to call G, which is a kind of coupling parameter, which more or less measures how much the prices are impacted by trading. So if you want, G is a mixture of how much each agent trades individually. If he trades large volumes, then G is large. But it's also related to the liquidity of the market. That is, if the market is very liquid, even if you're very large, you don't move the price too much. So G is large when the market is illiquid, and G is small if the market is very liquid. OK, so there are other parameters, but I won't mention them because they're less interesting in a first approximation. But let me show you, if you simulate this model. We take into account the fact that he has
he can die.
I don't give all the details, but he has a wealth and he updates his wealth, and if he becomes small, he can't trade anymore because he's too small, and so on. And there's also a time scale for determining the scores. The scores are only updated using past time scales. Very ancient, that's also what people do. I mean, if you look at very ancient... data, then you don't use it for trading. Okay, so... all this was skipped. Okay, so there's a kind of phase diagram in the plane polarization and G, coupling parameter, where one finds three different, qualitatively different patterns for stock markets. So there's one phase which we've called periodic, a phase that we've called stable, and a phase which we've called intermittent, because the artificial market is very much like one sees, I mean, has at least some features. So you see the periodic market goes like this. There are bubbles and crashes in a kind of periodic way. This obviously doesn't look at all like markets. This is a stable phase where the contrarian attitude of agents stabilize. So there's a fundamental price in this model which grows linearly with time. So you see that if people are contrarian enough, then no trend can really appear. Every trend is killed, has time to nucleate and establish itself. And so actually in this phase, there are very, very small fluctuations around the true price. So if you want, this would be the kind of efficient market that people talk about. And then there's a phase here which is interesting because it has a little bit of both. It has bubbles and crashes. It has periods where the volume and volatility are high. You can see that here. So that's the plot of the variation of prices. That's the plot of the volume. And so you see that there are periods where the volatility is very small, periods where it's larger. And if you look at how these the correlation function of the vol decays with time, it's reasonably close to what one sees in data. You can also look at distributions. So that's the distribution of returns, and that's a power law with an index 3.4. So you see that, I mean, this is not claimed to be realistic at all. I mean, it's models are not to fit data, they are to sharpen questions. So this is not claimed to be realistic. It's just to see that it's very easy to get. So that's, okay, so I'm going to kill that. So now the question is the question you ask. I mean, how can you reasonably argue that the system is going to spontaneously evolve in the region that we see it? Well, the fact that suddenly something like this is true in reality, I think, for me, is quite obvious. I mean, agents, human beings, tend to be trend followers. They tend to have some kind of mimetic feeling. And so it's much easier to say, well, everybody's doing this, I'm going to do the same, than to have the guts to say, I'm going to say something else. I'm not speaking about Chirac. But, so that's the first thing. It's reasonable that probably one is in a system where it's easy to amplify trends. The second thing is about G. So if you remember, if you fix P, so there was a phase diagram like this, G, P, and so zero was around here. So if you fix P to be positive, there's a whole region where the market is periodic. That has it has long bubbles and crashes and intermittent.
Is the period determined in part by M?
By M. Yeah, it's determined by various things. I mean, it's determined also by G. And, okay.
There's no simple relation to M in that.
No.
But P is the average quantity, or is each
yeah. No. P is an average quantity. It's a bias in strategy space.
But in principle, you can imagine that each agent has his own P.
Well, it's an average over all agents. So each agent has a realization of something which is on average biased. But you can be, even in this phase, you can have a contrarian agent.
Sure. Yeah, okay.
So if you look at this market, and the same argument is actually also true in other cases, what you see is that if G was too small, that is, if players played a too small amount of capital, then trends would easily come about, and so the markets would be predictable, at least for a while. And so clearly, people would invest more. So there's a quite natural mechanism that would make G increase. But then as you penetrate this region, the market becomes unpredictable and extremely volatile. And so this would deter people from playing more. So you kind of expect that something like this might take place. Although, of course, working out this in more details needs to be more thoroughly thought about. But there might be a generic reason for markets to behave close to a critical point, because if they're too stable, then it's too easy to predict. And if they're completely volatile, then nobody would like to play. So perhaps in a kind of generic fashion, this is the way it goes. OK, so do I have to stop, or do I have just 5 more minutes to? Okay, so this model is nice, but again, there are many models of the same kind, and I don't have time to tell you what can be done analytically on this model. Not much, but there's something that one can do, and that we've done with Irene and Marc Mézard, is to try to understand where these long-range volatility fluctuations come from. And there's a kind of nice and generic mechanism that allows you to understand how you generate very long time scales in this model without necessarily be at a critical point. So this, for those who are interested, I can try to explain. But I'm going rather to tell you about a very simplified model to try to understand the feedback loop that is here. And so this is something that we just finished with Mathieu Villard. So this is based on similar ideas, but trying to strip down the model as much as we can to get something that is tractable. So we assume that there is a price change delta PT, and then there's some information, which can be the price change itself, but it can be something else, like recently when the war began, the stock markets went up. And so that's a kind of tradition in stock markets history, that every time a war begins, the stock markets go up. And so you can ask why, and that's one of the things that this model is intended to do. So we're going to call delta I of t some kind of information that is thought, for good reasons or bad reasons, to affect the price. And so what it means is that we're going to assume that there is something like a correlation between delta P of T and delta I at time T minus 1. Okay? And actually, I'm going to write it like this. So people think that there is some kind of correlation between information and price changes. So what are they going to do if they think this is true? They're going to try to measure this correlation on past data. Okay, so a way to make this more mathematical is to say that they are going to measure a correlation function, which is, say, the sum from t prime equal minus infinity to t minus 1 of alpha to the t minus t prime time delta p t prime delta I of t prime minus 1. So this, if you want, is a kind of exponential moving average of the actual history. So if alpha was going to 1, then this would be the true correlation, because you would measure it on an infinite time scale. But if alpha is less than 1, then you only measure it on a recent past. And there's some normalization here that I... It doesn't matter. I is some external indicator. It might be the price itself, and I'm going to tell a little bit about that at the end. But it might be, for example, the bond index. People in stock markets look a lot at the bond index. It could be, you know, the dollar, it could be inflation, it could be whatever. This is a source of information. Okay, so now what is very, very reasonable and very similar to this step here is that if a fraction of people play with these correlations in their head, then the actual price change, delta P of T, is going to be a sum of whatever price change would have occurred without these strategic agents that try to extract some value from these correlations, plus something, which I'm going to call G, with analogy with this coupling parameter, of the measured correlation function at time T, time delta T, delta I of T minus 1. So this means that if you had some of these correlations, then CT delta I T minus 1 would be the best linear predictor of the future price change. So it's very natural that a fraction of people play according to this. And actually, one should have a function here of this quantity, because even if the signal is very large, people won't play an infinite number of amount of money. So there's some saturation. So now if you're with me at this stage, then, although I don't have time to give you all the details, but it's pretty trivial, one can write down an equation for C, which in the continuous time limit, that is in the limit where alpha goes to 1, is a Langevin equation. It's dc t by dt equals g minus 1 ct minus h CT cube plus the Langevin noise. And possibly, if there is some true correlation between the two things, then there would be a constant term that people in the field call beta. So, well, I don't have to say much more, but if you see this as a particle in a potential, then obviously when g is less than 1, you have a stable point around 0. So the correlations, the real correlation, so that's for beta equals 0. So the correlations oscillate around their true value 0. But then if the coupling becomes too large, then you have two non-trivial values of correlations that can spontaneously occur, even if beta is 0. So that even if there is no correlation whatsoever between the war beginning and the stock markets increasing, the very fact that people believe it's so can be enough to make this happen. So this is what people call in the field self-fulfilling prophecies.
What is beta again?
It's the true correlation, the real absolute true correlation between.
It's as likely to go up as down.
Yes, where is it? It can be positive or negative.
I'm sorry.
Where can it be positive or negative?
Because if people start thinking that that for example wars induce prices to go down, then they will play according to it, and this will give a negative correlation. So what is quite interesting in this case is that you really have a very simple scenario for the appearance of what people call conventions, that is, laws that everybody believes in, which have no fundamental justification. And this can occur through this simple mechanism. So a nice case is when delta I is the price itself. And then these two conventions correspond to trend-following bubbles and contrarian bubbles. And what is quite nice is that if you look at this model and average over long times, then the average correlation is still zero. So you see that in this case, you have a model which is compatible with the empirical assumption or the empirical evidence that delta I, delta j is delta ij. So on average, over everything, there's no correlation. But it doesn't mean that locally there are no correlations. And actually, if you listen to traders, they always tell you that the markets is in a trend-following phase. For the moment, it's good to be trend-follower. And in other cases, they say, well, the market is very much reverting and contrarian. So you see that very, very simply, you can have a quite complex time series, which from a naive analysis would give you absence of linear correlations. But this hides a lot of things happening. In particular, this model has also excess volatility and volatility clustering and all these things.
In the real world, in your model, do you have any way of, in the actual market tend to discount a lot of information because it already expects this to happen? Like this morning's news that Bush is giving his friend Cheney company a huge Iraq contract. But presumably, there's no sense in buying stocks in Halliburton now because the market already knows this, expects that Bush is going to do that. But in this kind of model, there's no mechanism.
Well, yes, okay, I see what you mean, and that's interesting because it's related to this efficient market thing. So you could add here a mean reverting term,
yes,
which would be minus kappa pt minus p0. So this is a fundamental price that you're supposed to know. And then if pt is already much too high compared to p0, then you're going to mean revert. So I think that the real model should include this term, but when you look at actual data, then if there is some mean reversion in data, it corresponds to 5 years, a five-year time scale. So it's a very long mean reversion. And what it means is that if you want P0, nobody knows what it is. There's no way to compute P0. And that's the whole thing that pervades efficient market theory, and which is very unrealistic, is that nobody has a good way to measure P0. So you could argue, and that actually I'm going to finish on that, that P0 is known up to a factor 2, okay? And roughly speaking, no people know the price up to a factor 2, not better than this. And then the time scale at which this term should intervene is when the volatility of markets, that is square root of the volatility times the time scale that you're looking for, is 50%, okay? And this gives you around 5 years. So that's not incompatible with what we know about markets. Well, I'm sorry I've overspilled, but thank you for your attention.
I mean, suppose if I were cynical and maybe a government not much interested in profit, but interested in destabilizing the market, could I do that?
Yes.
And is that in any of these terms?
No. That's something that perhaps I would have liked to discuss about the order book thing. And you can indeed, it's actually, most people are interested to perturb markets as little as possible. So there's the other question that is in most people's mind, for the reason I told you earlier, that if you want to do something, you don't want to push the market in the same direction as you. But the other thing would be very easy, actually. I mean, if you just have to look at the number of shares that... there's an interesting story about this. A few months ago on the DAX, the German stock market, a trader apparently made an error. That is, he typed his price with a factor 10 mistake. Okay, so instead of typing, 4,250, he typed 425, and so suddenly there was this big order there standing at 425. So for a while, people thought, "Wow, this guy has some information. We all must sell because the market is, for some reason, going down." And you really see on the time series that the market is plunging before people realize that it's an error, and then it goes back up. So actually, this sometimes happens without people wanting it. But indeed, if at any instant of time, there is actually in the order book a very small fraction of the company total capital. So if if you want to have a whack at it and put an enormous amount in face of it, you're going to drive the price crazy. And then people may think that you have some information, and this is enough to destabilize the market.